There it is. Ladies and gentlemen, another episode of Mixed Mental Arts. And we have a very special guest, other than probably our most popular guest over the years.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. Mike Callen is in the house. He's wearing a very orange shirt with his down jacket on. He could give zero Fs about any of us. 77 tomorrow, by the way.
Wow.
77 tomorrow.
Apparently not aging runs in the family.
Yeah, he does well. He looks good.
That was not my reaction.
Let's get those wires away from the dogs. We got my dogs are playing. My dog will zonk out pretty soon. I got a puppy. Big Mike, 77. What have you learned, huh? Teach us the secrets. We were talking about, I was trying to pick your brain on the Trump phenomenon. And let me just, you guys, I'd like to hear what you have to say. I'm gonna put my dogs to sleep because they're annoying me.
You're gonna put them to sleep? You mean with a gun, kind of put to sleep?
No, it's not a gun.
Or is it, hypodermic needle? Trump, some random thoughts here. It is a slow, inexorable decline, and if you think about why that's happening, with occasional spurts. That people are too anxious to make into a trend. I'm thinking at the moment about his Saudi trip, his speech in Saudi Arabia, which was vintage Trump. There's a time for that type of thing. I'm thinking about the Syrian rocket attacks.
Try to talk into the mic more.
And there are a few other, his appointment, a lot of his cabinet. And, of course, the high point is clearly Gorsuch in the Supreme Court. For those who are center to right of center, I'm talking about. Now, what's really happening when you think about this is he is being his completely irresponsible, impulsive self. And every time he is doing that, you can see it in the numbers, the amount of support declines. The problem he has is that there's almost no prospect of recovering from this. And the reason for it is, as I said on a previous podcast, the yawning gap between campaigning and governing. Most of his support come from people who were agitated about globalization. You might even include me, who couldn't stand the thought of Hillary Clinton being rewarded for being one of the most dishonest public figures in American history, thought. So my wife is the one that said, I'm 99% against Trump, but 100% against Hillary. He benefited from that, but that's gone. That was a vanishing asset. So that isn't there anymore. And now he's suffering all the shortcomings of a man that never reads anything, doesn't reflect very much, and is driven by a narcissistic personality, which people are beginning to realize can be quite dangerous. And so I can't imagine, if I were his son for that matter, how he would suddenly a year from now have a lot more support than he currently has, which has declined significantly from the inauguration because of his inveterate behavior. And then he makes several mistakes which could prove to be quite fatal. One of them is he puts labels on people. So if I disagree with you, and you and I have disagreed in our lives on certain issues, and it's gotten a point where we've been exasperated and walked away from each other, but I don't think I ever remember putting a label on you and saying that you aren't.
No, calling a name or, yeah.
Because that's a direct attack on self-esteem, which we've learned a long time ago is the worst thing that you can do, one human being on another. You cannot attack and someone's self-esteem.
Well, it just gets in the way of the idea. It gets in the way of, it gets in the way of trying to solve the problem. So it's you make it personal. It has nothing to do really with the two people. It has more to do with solving the problem. That's where every discussion should start. We all agree there's a problem. Let's agree that it's on the fact that we agree that it's the same problem, and then let's try to work from there. Hunter and I always talk about this. You know, so much of your thinking is driven by your emotions and things. But let me switch gears for a second, because to what degree do you think you said you don't even read the New York Times anymore? To what degree do you think a lot of the mainstream media has discredited itself?
Well, it's an interesting subject. I don't disagree with Trump's attacks on the media because it's been so captured by a left-wing ideology in almost all of the main outlets. In the New York Times a long time ago, Sulzberger ought to be absolutely ashamed of himself for having turned what was at one time, when I was in my 20s, clearly a great newspaper, into the Pravda on the Hudson. You don't read anything in the New York Times anymore. Seriously.
For any of you guys who don't know that, young listeners, Pravda is the Russian newspaper. It actually means truth, and it was sort of the
propaganda rag.
The communist regime's rag. Yeah.
So that there is no one in the New York Times organization. They consider their token conservative to be David Brooks, who is an op-ed fellow, and by any standard is a very intelligent guy. But the idea that he would be a conservative is something of a rollicking joke. They've become, and it all happened with Vietnam, but we don't want to get into that. Arthur Sulzberger, who's a publisher and has been in part of that family for a long time, decided the United States shouldn't have been in Vietnam. Perfectly reasonable position to take in the fullness of time, probably the correct position. But he became a passionate ideologue, and he lost all sense of perspective, and objectivity was thrown out the window. I'll give you an example of where it's come. I am very much anti-Trump. But if I were running the New York Times, I would not do what they did about a month ago. They ran 5 different front page articles, all of them raging negatives on Trump. Screeds, in fact. And 3 of those 5, and I read them carefully just to make sure I could say this with some credibility, 3 of those 5 were saying exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And it didn't add anything. But I said to you a little while ago, the problem with the New York Times, I think almost anybody now realizes that they have lost their colors, as we say. We all know what we're reading. We're reading the house organ of the left wing of the Democratic Party. And there is nothing that anybody at the center or to the right of that could ever say that they would be positive about. So it's too bad. They've lost it. And, you know, Trump says the failing New York Times. And in fact, economically, they're in big trouble. If it weren't for Carlos Slim in Mexico, who put $300 million, he's never going to see again.
Oh, is that right? I thought their subscriptions were up and everything else. Well, what do you think of The Atlantic?
I read it. I just read a very good piece, and they did this classic 20,000-word piece on Barack Obama's foreign policy by the guy who is now the editor-in-chief.
Yeah,
you have to read that if you're interested in foreign policy at all.
Yeah,
because it was done over a series of 10 different interviews with Obama over a long period of time. And he was able to develop all his thoughts, and the editor did a pretty good job of putting all that together. What their last issue was about, we don't want to get off on that. Their last issue was about, and we were actually, it's not irrelevant here. What has late night talk show television? I don't even know the people so much, but. This fellow, the Irishman, what's his name?
Conor O'Brien.
And who took Jay Leno's place?
There's Seth Meyers. There's Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel. Okay.
And then there's Jimmy Fallon.
They're all. I happen to get an email every day. Maybe you do. All their late night monologue jokes, like the New York Times. See, so what the mainstream media has done is boxed itself so that nobody can say anything neutral or positive about one person, that is President of the United States. Now, here, I'm not coming out of that door the way you think I might. Here is how I'm coming out of it. The New York Times itself, when you pick up the newspaper, you know what you're going to get. It would be like reading Pravda. You know, there's no surprise. However, if you think Charlie Rose on PBS, who has a talk show I record every night, is objective and somebody you can get a good two-sided view from. Remember that Charlie Rose never has an issue on politics without 2 or 3 New York Times reporters there. And occasionally he'll throw in a Washington Post reporter. So you're getting the New York Times view, but you don't know what's happening to you.
So I take it the Wall Street Journal is the publication you take more seriously.
I do like their editorials, and I think they've become an excellent newspaper. Yes.
What about The Economist?
I read it religiously, almost cover to cover every week. And it's got the big advantage of not being American.
Yeah.
Why is that being banned by more countries than any other publication in history?
Why is that an advantage?
Well, British journalism is generally accepted to be superior in its quality, its objectivity.
I think they're better at taking themselves out of the equation. It's very un-British to give your own personal point of view or to make yourself the center of the storm. And, you know, someone like Sean Hannity.
Yeah.
He's in direct violation of that. Like a guy like that who.
But everybody knows that.
Yeah, right? That's how he sells. I mean, you know, O'Reilly. This is how these guys sell their. That's why they're.
Yeah,
he was the guy behind
the Tea Party and all that. But when you turn on TV and you see Sean Hannity, from my point of view, he seems like a very nice guy.
Yeah.
He's got the right ethnic background, from my point of view.
What do you mean?
Hannity and Callan? Come on.
Oh, you mean Irish?
More. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But it's one of these things where you know what you're going to say. But let me make my main point on what is now called MSM, the mainstream media. Don't underestimate its power. It's less. But if anything you hear from those channels, directly on Charlie Rose, or directly by reading their publications, is negative Trump, don't for a second think that that isn't going to influence you over a 2, 3, 4 year period, because it is. I mean, it takes hard work to say these guys are only putting one side of this forward to the public. But everything I'm saying is
Trump is
such
a special circumstance. He's just his own worst enemy, and there are plenty of conservative publications that have a problem with him too.
Well, I think
he's been talked to death. You know,
yeah, and I think, but in general, the larger problem is that, you know, it used to be that you had to read internationally publications, lots of different ones, to sort of get some sort of fair and balanced perspective. Now, even domestically, right? You know, they really have become foreign countries in many ways, like. You're going to get a whole different side of the view of the world if you read the New York Times than if you read the Wall Street Journal. And the challenge is that if you want to get any sort of realistic sense of what's going on, you really have to read widely.
Well, that's why we started this podcast. We called it Mixed Mental Arts. It was Hunter's idea. A mixed martial artist is somebody who can fight in all different arenas, on the ground, standing up. And I think that one of the things we notice is interviewing academics or any of these people, it's very difficult not to be to get ahead and get published in academia. The couple things you have to worry about. One is it's a nasty world. You better be very careful, you know, on what you say, and you better be able to bolster your point of view, your idea, your argument. So they're very careful. And also it probably requires... And I don't know but I think it does require a certain amount of focus where you can are in danger of becoming very myopic in your point of view on the world. And that's always been the case, I think, with academics. And of course, a lot of them are very smart and widely read. I don't think that's lost on them or anything. I'm not saying anything. They probably wouldn't criticize them themselves. But I think that what we're trying to do is kind of create this sort of well-rounded, we're trying to interview lots of different people and sort of create this well-rounded sort of place where you can come and hear lots of different perspectives, and it becomes sort of this idea dojo, you know, where the best idea wins. Let's talk about, you know, what is the evidence? What are all the independent lines of inquiry? You know, what is the consensus based on all of those independent lines of inquiry? Well, let's find the best idea.
And crucially, working across disciplines, because the problem is that, you know, so somebody in the Mixed Mental Arts Dojo shared this great quote with me from Aaron Levenstein, which is that statistics are like a bikini. What they hide is, what they reveal is interesting. What they hide is vital. And the problem is that it's very easy with a statistic to get some perspective or some picture, right, like Robert McNamara did. But that doesn't mean that you're actually seeing what the reality on the ground is or understanding the different sides and the different perspectives.
Two things on both sides of the barbell. On one side, a lot of the publications, the one I've been most personally in touch with on what I'm about to say is the Washington Post, but the New York Times a lot too. I have in my business career, when it, At one time, I was the press spokesman for Citi, which was the largest bank in the world, so there was a lot of interest. And I would have an interview with either one of the reporters from those two publications, and by vicariously, my probably dearest friend in the world, whose name I wouldn't feel free to mention, but my son knows, who was crucified by these two publications. You can have an interview, you can have a meeting, and you can read their reporting on those events the next day, and you were there, and you have no idea of where they got their information, their quotes, or anything of that kind. An example that's current choice is the supposedly Trump divulging information to the Russians, to Lavrov, and their American ambassador, and giving away top secrets. Where did that report come from? Because it didn't come from anybody in the meeting. And where is the verification of it? A guy that most people respect, even the left, McMaster, the National Security Advisor, who has got a long record of bipartisan, serious analysis, was in the meeting and went out and made a statement to the press, which I saw on TV, I think it was on Fox, saying, I was there and nothing I've seen reported happened.
Right.
Now, I'm a liar, which I don't think many people believe, but the legs on these reports, which are anonymous in nature, are remarkable. Why?
That's the biggest problem is fake news or just.
But let me make one other quick point. On the other side of the barbell, as I said a minute ago, the subtlety of their coverage. When you pick up the newspaper in the morning, you don't know what they're not putting on their front page. Their editor decided what stories he was going to carry. You can go to extremes. I said a second ago, the New York Times, 5 negative Trump articles on the front page, 3 on the same subject. That's extreme. And everybody now knows the New York Times. They would have a hell of a time finding investors. But it gets much, much more subtle than that. It's what they don't report, what they choose not to cover. And then you got this whole issue, is there any way of reversing this very far left-wing bias? And that's tough because of tenure.
Mm.
And because once you have established an editorial policy and an editorial staff who are selecting their reporters and their op-ed contributors, how do you get any countervailing force to that?
But I think, I mean, for me, I think the problem is that, I mean, as I watched the 2016 election, I saw two candidates and two parties who had no idea what they're doing. They didn't have any real solutions. They didn't have any practical proposals for what's going on. And I think that we've reached one of those moments in history where the people have to get together. Unfortunately, because of the internet, we have the tools to do that and clarify what it is that we want and then demand those things from our leaders. And we pick the leaders who are willing to deliver what we want. But we first have to get clear on what we want before we can even demand it.
But the whole history of our country, and I'm not sure it's bad, Hunter,
yeah,
is that you can go out and tell the people and have them shout and scream and yell, and you can get intoxicated with their reaction when you tell them you're going to do this, that, and the other thing. Trump is a perfect example of that. None of that could he have delivered, and none of that, his inability to deliver it, should have been a secret to anybody.
Well, but to a certain extent, you know, humans always have to burn their hand on the stove before they really learn the lesson.
Well, they've had an awful lot of hands burned off. Let's take the Mexican wall. It is not going to happen.
Yeah.
Because I don't even think, this may sound kind of extreme, I don't think the day he was sworn in, Trump realized how government funds whatever it is they want to spend money on. It has to originate in the House of Representatives. Cannot originate in the White House. I don't think he understood any of these subtleties, but tell me why any broad constituency, forget Republican, Democrat, any broad constituency in the House would be stepping up to fund a huge wall, especially when the issue of 12 million illegals are turning out not all to be criminals and rapists.
Right.
And especially when, ironically, we're in a period for the next 3 or 4 years of a fairly strong economy. An economy which is going to make the Mexican illegal threat less and less real. And by the way, if you start getting rid of some of these people and you're out there hoeing your garden or washing your car, whatever it is that the illegals have to do, you're going to start feeling it and seeing it from a very different perspective. Well, that was all demagoguery.
Well, and crucially, when they have shut down illegal labor in places like Alabama, you know, agriculture collapses, specifically because the agriculture rests on that sort of cheap labor. So economically, it's bad for everybody.
But let's switch gears for a second, because we were going to start this podcast about Charles Murray and Sam Harris. And I know you've read Charles Murray.
Oh, yeah.
Big Mike. So,
and then I think as a counterpoint to that, Thomas Sowell. Because, I mean, you know, Big Mike, the reason why I'm such a big fan of Black Rednecks, White Liberals is because of you. You were the one who
Thomas Sowell is one of the underrated but the most outstanding intellectuals of our time. For the audience that may not know that name, it has to be Black. He was sort of a sidekick of Bill Buckley's. Mm-hmm. And if you want to get some really good, Buckley used to have this program called Firing Line, and Sowell was very often on his program, and they used to have this format where they would talk for a while, and then they'd have a third party intellectual, some left wing person, and the issue would be immigration, or it could have been government spending, anything like that, and the third party would take on Thomas Sowell, a Black, and very often, and I think more likely than not, it was civil rights in those days, because the Civil Rights Act was passed in 64, and they would take on Sowell and try to shame him as a Black man for taking an opposite position. And whoever that, and you can see all this in YouTube, a wonderful medium, whoever that person was, Sowell was destroyed, would cut. And he's written a number of books, by the way.
Yeah.
None of them, they all would reward careful study. He's up in his 80s now. It's amazing.
And, I mean, one of the things that I think it would be amazing if this podcast achieved is to give Thomas Sowell the credit that he deserves and the attention that his work deserves before he passes.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I was talking with Katie O'Brien about this today, and this guy Scott Weigand, who runs the tutoring program at Los Angeles Valley College, which obviously has a very diverse population. And, you know, we were talking about why hasn't Sowell's work gotten more attention? And I think a big part of the problem is that it holds everyone accountable.
Yeah.
And that is not something that anybody wants.
No, everybody wants somebody to blame.
That's right.
You know, and there are people to blame.
That's right.
It is true that this country, if you're African American in this country, you can study the history. It generally, I always find it appalling and amazing that it was just a continual onslaught.
Yeah.
It was tough. Still is tough. It just, for a lot of reasons. It's not because, I don't even think it's even racism. I don't think it's deliberate racism. It's not like that anymore. It's way more complicated and subtle than that. But there are a lot of reasons. You know, but it was tough. And there was for a long time, you know, deliberate white efforts to keep Black people down.
But,
you know,
I think
that might be where I'm saying that might be where a lot of people get emotional when they read Sowell, and Sowell says,
of course, people,
this is also a part of their culture that they took from the Irish and from the Scottish slave owners who transferred their culture onto these Africans who are,
well, you know. Of course, and white liberals won't like it, because white liberals find out that by refusing to have a conversation about culture, they've actually been holding back the people that they've been claiming that they've been trying to help. But I think it's, you know, the real issue is the culture of the United States as a whole. You know, the United States is one big family, and it's either a dysfunctional family or a family that is functional because it talks out its difficult problems.
Right.
And, you know, that's the problem with Sowell's book is that it is a solution, but it's a difficult solution. And it's a solution that requires us to confront a lot of uncomfortable truths. And Jordan Peterson, when he was on Rogan's podcast recently, was talking about how horrible the truth is, because the truth burns.
Hmm.
And, you know, I would like to, you know, let everybody be, everybody I who I've managed to pass on Big Mike's wreck of Black Rednecks, White Liberals to, it has burned them, but they've come out better on the other side for it.
good ideas, you know,
that need to move, and they need to be packaged, and they need a wider audience.
Well, Charles Murray's a guy who got continues to be crucified for
Charles Murray's just a scientist, sociologist, and the science doesn't always go to the left. I mean, the conclusions, if you really are scientific.
Well, Big
about
Mike, let's talk about the science here. Because one of the most important things in science is that correlation is not causation.
Right.
It's rule number one, right? One of the most basic rules. And the whole point of, you know, black, rednecks, white liberals is that there is a correlation between race and IQ. But as Sowell points out, that's because 9/10 of black people are from that redneck culture, whereas only 1/3 of white people are from that redneck culture. So it's actually, and when you regroup based on culture, you find out that IQ correlates with culture. And when you add that together with Joe Henrich's work on The Secret of Our Success, you get a compelling picture that actually the causal factor in IQ is culture.
Because it continues to, they continue to have to adjust the average. So it was 70.
Mm-hmm.
IQ at 70 in 1815 was normal. Now, you start at 100. That would be they had to average up to 100.
Yep, they keep on having to re-norm. And so essentially, a person from 1815, if they took an IQ test today, would be functionally retarded.
And, then read Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart,
mm-hmm.
where he points out, I think cogently, that the United States and its communities are becoming, on the one hand, fishtown, populated by a large group of unskilled, maybe high school graduates, and comparing where they are today to where they were in the 60s, for example. And the other side is Levittown, which I think that's correct. My memory serves. I read this book about a year and a half ago, where you have the law school graduates and the doctors and all those upper middle class group. And what is the relationship one to another? There isn't one.
Well, and the crucial thing is, why isn't there a relationship? And this ties back into what's happened with the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, which is that tribalism has set in, factionalism has set in, and there isn't a communication between the two cultures, and you need to form a new shared national myth. You need to basically, you know, it's the central challenge of history. It's what Muhammad had to deal with the tribes are warring, and you need a new larger myth that binds people together. That's what, you know.
Well, one of the central themes of my thinking, and you raise it right here, is whenever we read the daily press today or watch daily television, you could be forgiven from coming away from the headlines saying the world's really in deep kimchi and mm-hmm. everything is terrible. And in fact, that's where Matt Ridley, who's just written another book after The Rational Optimist called The Evolution of Everything, I think he could have come up with a better title, where he's talking about, and I've given you a couple of recommendations, one called Progress, which takes a sweeping view since the turn of the 20th century up through today. Where is the man in the street now versus mm-hmm. where he was? And you don't have to go back that far. You can go back to the 60s when I was a college student. There is absolutely no comparison. My wife points out very often, to be poor in today's world is something altogether different than to have been poor in the 60s anywhere, whether it's New York or in the South. So there has been a general uplifting of living standards. But if you're after political power, that's not a message you want to talk about.
Of course not.
And so you are going to, and if you look at what the political campaigns are about, and I've said this on this podcast before, they're all about intent.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get anybody or any institution in our democracy that makes an honest attempt to evaluate the results of government effort. Where the rest of us live in a world of results. I don't know what you do about measuring the response to these podcasts. You do something and you know that you're getting more than you did a year ago. And the other things I know my son does, he can measure all these things. The government doesn't measure anything. And the results of everything they have done has been really quite abysmal. But then there's no competition. So because I have maybe more than 10 people on this podcast, I'm going to say what I've said before, and I just want to keep grinding it sometimes the communists prove the mantra after you say it often enough and everybody starts believing it. In 1955, Fortune magazine published its list of the top 500 companies, and John Kenneth Galbraith and other intellectuals wrote books, The New Industrial State, and One Thing and Another, saying those are the entities that control our lives. Well, the facts are, and Kenneth Galbraith died in his 90s and to his credit admitted this, the competition among those entities means that there's only about 60 of them left. 440 disappeared through merger, through bankruptcy. They were replaced by companies nobody ever would have believed, like Yahoo. That was somebody that lived in the country and couldn't read and write.
Yahoo.
I love that Big Mike's example is a company that has since been displaced.
But at the same time, somebody still has to come up, and I've laid this challenge out in my classes at university and elsewhere. Find me one government organization that has disappeared over that same period of time. Because once you establish a committee, an agency of any kind in government, it's there forever.
But what makes government agencies disappear, Big Mike?
Nothing.
Oh, there is one thing.
There's no force.
No.
What is it?
James, you know, the Federalist Papers are very clear on this, that ultimately the best check
Talk
on the...
Talk about going back.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I don't think that you're going to, in terms of understanding how this country's supposed to work, I don't think you're going to find better clarity. But it was very clear that ultimately the best check on the government will always be the people.
Okay.
But...
Before you go on, okay. I just want to make a point. Thomas Sowell has been parading in front of his readers for years.
Good.
What has happened today is the civil service, which is not elected by the people, and the courts are running the country.
Yeah.
Very literally running the country. The best thing Trump can do, Trump's not all bad, no matter what the archive says. He's going to start appointing a lot of judges. He may get another shot at the Supreme Court if Brennan retires. In fact, if Brennan retires next month, toward the end of next month, he may. Trump probably has a political capital, something we should talk about, political capital. He probably has political capital to get another Supreme Court appointment. And he's got a raft of circuit court appointments that he's putting forward. And they're not going to be as controversial. With his majority in Congress, now that they've exercised the nuclear option, he'll get them in place. They'll all be constructionists. They will not be out there making laws. Now, that's anathema to some people. But the civil service, what Donald Trump's learning right now, what Obama before him, didn't matter what their ideology was, what they're all learning is you don't control the government. The civil service does. Bill Clinton said something recently, not publicly, but he said something recently that I found rather startling. And that is that the intelligence community, you see presidents come and see tell presidents go. They don't tell them everything they know.
Mm-hmm.
You imagine the intelligence community is not going to tell the president of the United States everything that they know.
Why?
Because that gives their power away.
Yeah.
And they'll wait until the next guy comes along. They'll give him what is useful to give him.
So there is a deep state.
Yeah, of course. When you build government the way we have and expand it to the degree we have, you've got, and I meet a lot of these people, civil servants who have been there 30 and 40 years.
So this, when you say civil servants who run this, you're talking about people in the State Department and the CIA and the Defense Intelligence.
Bureaucrats. And Health and Human Services.
But Big Mike, that's been a factor in every single government throughout history. The Chinese emperors had the eunuchs, and the eunuchs would co-opt power.
Well, by
the
way, a lot of these people, in fact, are eunuchs.
Eunuchs. Well, but they're always, whenever you have powerful people, they're always weaselly little worm tongues.
My argument is it's gotten much worse. And I think makes that point.
But the point is that it's easy to continually talk about problems. What is the solution? And, you know, Abraham Lincoln said that, you know, the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation is the philosophy of government in the next. And so if you want to look at what's wrong in the philosophy of government now, you have to go back a generation.
This is why Jordan Peterson's freaking out about academia, this cultural Marxism.
Well, it's too late. Opinions. My problem is that Donald Trump is not the solution. And there were a whole lot of people out there of the 72% of the whites, and I guess maybe I've said this on our last podcast, the thing I still can't get my head around the fact that 53% of that 72%, the women, that 53% of the white women voted for Donald Trump.
They just hated Hillary that much. They just didn't trust her.
Well, it's also
they just didn't believe her. Women have very good antenna.
Your mother was.
She didn't like Hillary. She never did.
Also, she becomes unhinged when you start talking about Hillary.
Yeah,
but also it's part of it was also honor culture. It's intuitions of loyalty, and the point is that you know I read this amazing interview with this woman who was she you know was like voted for Trump, and you know it was clear that like her husband was dying and needed you know the Affordable Care Act, right? And you know they proceeded to explain to her that Trump was going, you know, was promising to take away whatever particular care she had, and she hadn't realized this.
Yeah.
Right? Like she voted against her own interests, but mm-hmm. her intuitions of loyalty and wanting to fit into her community were so strong that she wasn't really making an independent decision. She was being motivated by social pressure.
Mm. What? Yeah. No, I
know. My wife of 52 years is here, and I'm usually very, very respectful.
well.
And I'm just wondering if she has anything she'd like to contribute to this.
Except that I have to say.
I knew the except was going to use this and put it up next year.
No, what was very interesting was that the social pressure before the election not to admit if you were going to vote for Trump was enormous.
That's right.
People looked at you like you were, I'm talking about my peers, looked at me like I was absolutely out of my mind. But I really think it's best put this way. I was 100%.
I already said that.
You said that. Okay. So that, but what was amazing to me, because I'm a woman who doesn't work, so I don't have to toe the line. I can be free and independent.
The product of your work is sitting right here, not me.
That's right. You raised me. The great Brian Callen.
You know, as a housewife, I don't have to answer to anybody. And it was the first time in my life that I found people, you know, treating me as if I was a complete nut. And they didn't even care to hear why I thought the way I did. I found that very surprising. So imagine for people who are in universities or in jobs, they're not going to say what they think. And thank God for the vote being anonymous.
Yeah.
I mean, I never really appreciated it until this election.
That's right.
Well, I don't think your vote's anonymous anymore, Aunt Vic.
Well, listen, man. The Democrats bear the blame for that.
Well, no, but if you
they,
turn
they,
from
they told them they didn't want her in 2008.
I listened to your podcast. They're about grand philosophy, and they're about grand philosophy in 30-minute soliloquies by Hunter. But and I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with that, I'm just saying what I think is interesting in the new is if you start sit back and think for a second, is there anything Trump could do if you were in Trump's shoes and you were you, not him? I think it's too late to regain the political capital. By the way, I want to define political capital. It's used a lot of overused. Political capital is what Ronald Reagan had, which means you have a lot more power than the number of votes you got. It means that you can say to the Congress and both parties, we really ought to do this, and I know a lot of you don't agree with it, but if you don't vote for this, or God forbid you vote against it, I am going to make it a big part of my campaign, and even before the election, years before the election, I'm going to go out and tell people that you should really be sowing wheat or something, but not be in Congress. And that had very great power. Nobody, whatever the ideology, wanted Ronald Reagan to get up and say, get rid of Brian. Because it would cost that person, if not the election, 5% of the voting population as soon as he said that. Now, Trump has none of that.
Mm.
It's gone. So as far as his tax plan, as far as his immigration plan, that goddamn wall, all the rest of this, I just can't see it happening. And that means you've got a guy sitting there for 3.5 years and everybody's trying to impeach him. But that's a very difficult thing, fortunately, in our republic. unless they come up with him and Putin in bed together or something. But that's a very difficult thing to do, which means, you know, you're going to have dysfunctional government again. But the best we can get out of that is the judiciary, including the Supreme Court. That's what you've got to look for.
That's for sure.
But at the same time, Big Mike, for somebody who is in their 30s, right, you know, the trend of this country is not good. Right. If you start the clock at World War II, I think the trend is going in a bad direction. So at some point, the ship of state needs to be turned. And that really comes down to the people being educated enough to be able to make better decisions. And we have the internet to be able to do that. And I mean, what would you say if you were in your 30s?
Well, I wouldn't agree with what you just said. The first thing I would say is, be very, very careful about predicting the future, because there were a lot of people when I was in my 30s, and I remember it distinctly, and my wife and I have been married forever, so she can bear this, you know, I give you examples, like we lived in India. India was going to starve to death. You remember Paul Ehrlichman, or Ehrlich? What a disgrace. What a total disgrace. India's got twice the population than when we lived there, consuming twice the calories per person. There is no more starvation in India. And I go through a list for you right now. Nobody predicted. Nobody. And I said a little while ago, living standards, by and large, are a lot higher. What's in the way is the media has changed dramatically so that you've got 1,000 cable channels. They're all out there trying to gain the same audience. And you do that with headlines, and you do that so you're talked about. And there is absolutely no incentive or profit in coming out with good, dull news. You've got to come out with something that tells you that the country is on its way to being half homeless. Now, let's take an example that's very current, Daily Press. We aren't going to have any more jobs, driverless cars, driverless trucks, and then you hear a lot of statistics. That sounds daunting. And I would go back a little bit before that. We're running out of energy. Absolutely running out of energy. Paul Ehrlich, the world's going to starve to death. Turns out none of that has ever turned out to be true. The missing factor in every one of these grandiose predictions is the lack of appreciation at all of the ability of human beings to adapt.
Yeah.
They're incredible to adapt and innovate when it's in their interest to do so. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't agree with you, but I would understand what you're saying. And I would point out that every academic, every guy of your intellectual level has this handicap of saying things have never been worse. This world needs me more than it ever has.
Well, firstly, negativity bias, right? I understand negativity bias, and I agree with you. I'm a big fan of Matt Ridley's theory of everything, and I think the arc of history, I just did a podcast about this, does tend towards improvement. I think that things are getting better. I just think that it's going to require work to make things better, and that's my point. But
not at a central point like Washington, D.C.
No. That's what I'm saying. I think it's a conversation on the internet. I think it's the people.
You get very few people who agree with you on that. Because every time, if I say, we have a lot of work to do. The second thought is, it's got to be done in Washington.
No, but
by the smart folks.
No, I think that's the point is, I think that, and this is, I think, a large point of this podcast, is the smart folks, the university academics, they, in the same way as you're talking about with the deep state, they have an incentive to not share their ideas because their ideas are power. And so they want to create as much obscurity and confusion and inaccessibility. And the ivory tower is very much real. And that's why most people don't feel qualified to question or think about these things, because they feel that it's beyond them. And they don't want to be shouted down or humiliated or told that they're wrong if they speak out of turn. And so I think that precisely our job, and a large part of the job of this podcast and what Katie and I were doing with the Straight A Conspiracy, is to empower people to have confidence in their own resourcefulness and their own ability to figure out their own problems.
I just want to complete a thought. I don't disagree with anything you just said, but the thought I want to complete is all our jobs going away, and the world is clearly this time coming to an end. This time it's different. and then what happens is we, and there's an interesting bottom line to all this. We're reading that employment has been growing faster than anybody anticipated, about 250,000 new jobs a month. That's a lot. Unemployment, a flawed measure, by the way, significantly flawed measure, but nevertheless, would indicate at the level it's at now, full employment in the country. And in response to the Jesse Jackson argument, they're all hamburger flippers. Sorry, Jesse, you lose again because total incomes, total wages are on a real basis are growing, are coming up. Now, here's my bottom line. Trump, once again, intoxicated by the mobs, has said, I'll give you 3 or 4% growth, the way we had in Reagan's days, and you will, everybody will be happy. Now, I would agree if you get 3 or 4% growth, your problems go away very quickly. Those homeless people are being dragged by guys with shirts and ties saying, come on, we need you. You got to do something. We can wash you up and shave you. We got to have somebody doing this. The reason you're not going to get that growth, and he's again going to disappoint his constituency, is demographics. It's not government policy. It's demographics. We don't have a growing labor force, a growing skilled labor force. And when you put that into the equation of where you get growth, you get it from labor and you get it from capital. We got plenty of capital. We don't have labor.
Mm.
And people find that very surprising because they're focused on the homeless person. We just came from 6 weeks in Manhattan, and our apartment happens to be in the center of the citadel of homelessness because you can't walk to a restaurant without having some guy, and I'm dropping $5 bills and the woman who has been there now for a year and a half, she says, I'm homeless and pregnant. She must have about 5 children by this time. I've been dropping $5 into her jar. Interesting, by the way.
Yeah.
When I do that, I look in the reflection in the window, and it never takes more than a minute for somebody else to look at me having done that and said, and they go and
peer pressure.
Maybe 25.
She's making money.
But if you look at that and you're so influenced by it, the world is, isn't that, look at these poor souls, but those poor souls have always been there. And a lot of what people are comparing us today, it's always been there, only it's been worse.
Yeah, I mean, half of India was starving and half of China for a long time, and all those places where, you know, half the world was under communist or military dictatorships. And
And I think almost everybody knows this, but let's not forget when we're talking about our jobs are going away, all the bad things that happened that we talk about in political campaigns, and we had Hillary saying, I'm going to solve it all by doing more of the same, and Trump saying, no, we're, you know, all this stuff we have to listen to. The truth of the matter is that the Chinese, thank you, Xi Jinping, have brought 400 million highly skilled, underpaid people into the world labor force.
Motivated.
Just the economics.
Yeah.
The economics. When do we ever have 400 million people suddenly appear in the world's labor force who are smart, educated, hardworking, and working for what we would consider slaves' wages? Now, that's going to disappear in time because their wages are going up.
It already is. China is losing jobs to Malaysia.
Right. But when you say what happened to our economy, what all our problems, that's where you ought to be focused. And Trump's answer is put walls up. Dumbest answer in the world.
My favorite is, I can't remember who said it, but he said something to the effect of, if you don't think things are getting better, if you don't think things are generally getting better, he said, would you rather live before anesthesia and antibiotics or after?
Yeah, that's true.
And not to mention vaccines, when you had to watch 5 of your 6 kids die of terrible diseases, tetanus and smallpox.
This also goes back to Matt Ridley's The Evolution of Everything.
Yeah.
Because there is a direction to evolution, and it is upwards. And that is the nature of the marketplace.
I think we're also getting, there's something else to consider. And there is becoming, because of technology, where I think it's making us in many ways at least more aware of how people live, how they suffer, where we're seeing it in Technicolor.
Well,
and so it makes us, you have a sense of almost this virtual reality notion of what it's like to be a refugee. I mean, mm-hmm. they have a lot of these organizations bring you into the tent I mean, there's a virtual reality experience of what it's like to be a refugee, and you're in the tent with them.
Yep.
And you're looking around.
I think that's an excellent point.
Yeah.
Well,
and so it makes you more compassionate. You can't help but to feel as though, and you know, and I'll tell you something else. After this Manchester bombing, Manchester's a tough town, never been there, but you know, I know people are there. That's an industrial town. Those are tough people, and they're proud people, and you wouldn't have trouble getting in a fight in Manchester in a bar in there. But I thought it was amazing when the mayor was saying, we're not going to let this divide us. Mm-hmm. We're not going to let this turn us into bigots. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're going to love each other harder and defy these terrorists, you know, by almost sort of realizing that diversity is our strength. Yep. And love is our strength. That's not something you would have heard back in the day.
No.
You would have had people say, these brown bastards, these Muslim this or whatever, and let's get a mob and let's go kick some ass. That's a very natural impulse. But so those ideas, those sort of ideas that, you know, look, it's not the person, it's not what you think, it's how you think. All these ideas are making headway.
Yeah.
And I think there's much to be celebrated. Now, I always like what you say, Hunter. It's one thing to say that the world's getting better, but that can breed complacency.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be careful with that too.
And that's, I think, the biggest
thing. Because there is an urgency as well.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing is that, you know, one of the people in your son's empire, the Caliphate.
Call it the Caliphate. that's Hunter.
But
taking over the world.
But he shared with us this Chinese saying that is, heaven is high and the emperor is far away.
I love it.
And, you know, there's such a tendency to focus on Washington and to think that that is either the cause of or the answer to all your problems. But the reality is that the majority of the success of humanity is dependent upon us. And, you know, that's the point of Sowell's work is that, you know, hey, you know, your problems are not made by government or made by these ancient historical forces of the slave experience. They're made by the choices that you make in your own lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really my point, Big Mike, is to say that personal responsibility and taking ownership over your own life and doing whatever you can to improve.
Look, that's the best. I think any other philosophy is bankrupt. That's the best course of action, the best mindset, and the best philosophy to adhere by, because it's not always going to work out. Okay. You're not always going to have the things are not always going to happen, you know, but if you don't adhere to that philosophy, you don't embrace that, good luck. Nobody owes you a goddamn thing. I think it was Amelia Bloom who said that if there's a billboard and she could put anything on it, it would be nobody owes you anything. Nobody owes anybody anything. And I'll tell you something else. Nobody really cares enough to get you out of your problems. If you want to rely on charity, you go ahead and good luck. Stand in front of the church or the temple or the mosque and see how it goes for you. Fine. Or rely on the state. But we are too busy, all of us. I'm too busy to actually open an orphanage. I wish I could. Well, I don't even know what that means, but I don't like saying that, but all of us are too busy. I got enough trouble taking care of my own garden here, mm-hmm. my children, raising my children, my marriage, all that stuff. So you better watch out for yourself. It's not always going to work out. And I happen at 50, I think the best way to realize the best course of action is you're going to lose and fail probably. And I'm successful, kind of. I mean, I think I am.
You know? Brian, you're a huge star.
I mean, in a way, I'm a success objectively, right? If you look at everything, you know, I hate even, but I think I fail. I think I failed. And I'm not exaggerating. I think I've failed 94% of the time, probably 96% of the time. I'm not joking.
Yeah.
In fact, I still watch myself, you know, I guess this character on the Goldbergs is popular or whatever. I watch my stand-up. I cringe. You know, I'm big. I'm broad. I'm not deep. There's a thousand things. I don't like myself very much. Oh, and that's another thing while I'm pontificating. I'm tired of this philosophy. You got to love yourself. I don't like myself at all, which is one of the things that drives me. I am a huge hole, an endless hole that can never be filled. Thank God, because it's what wakes me up. Yeah, I'm a mess. And one more thing. Yeah. Every time I look at a mirror, I never met a mirror I didn't like. But I'm not admiring myself. I'm always hoping something's going to change. Because I spend so much time exercising.
I'm glad your mother is here to listen to this.
I think
and I want to say one more thing. I want to get, but I will compliment myself, you bastards. And this is for if you're in the Los Angeles area anywhere, David Maxwell, Max, is the greatest tennis coach in the world, teaches my kids. And he's worked, I 3 years ago, I was humiliated in Biarritz and I said, I can't play tennis. And I said, I'm going to learn how to play tennis. And I've been taking lessons from this guy, Max. And the other day I was hitting the ball with this pro that I have to pay people to hit with me. And he was hitting it right to me, so I look great. But I was grooving my stroke and I was wearing a hat that Max wears. And a guy through the mesh, he could only see my silhouette. And I kept hearing, Max, Max, Max. And as he looked, he saw it was me and it wasn't Max. And that's how good my stroke was. You bastards. So I'll give myself that. I can't win a game. I can't win a set off of anybody's remotely good, but I look like I can. If you're hitting the ball to me and I'm warmed up and it's in a stretch of about 5 minutes. So kiss my ass, America.
Quick anecdote. When I used to play tennis a little bit, we were living in Greenwich, the Stanwich Country Club.
Yeah.
Yvonne Lendl, who was number one in the world, was a member then. Getting ready for the U.S. Open, mm-hmm. He was out there. I went and I had a lesson with Don. I don't remember anything else but Don. And Don was out there hitting balls with Lendl. Mm. So they finished because time came, and Don had to go back to work teaching me in this case. So Lendl went off the court, and I went out there, and Don and I started hitting back and forth. I could tell Don was not as a buoyant self. He was way down. And we met at the net, and I said, Don, you had something. I hope nothing happened. The family or anything, he said, no. He said, look, you don't understand. You don't understand what it's like. He said, my life is tennis. That's what I chose to do to make a living. He said, I was just out here playing with this guy that you were watching and several other people, and we were hitting it back and forth, and any time he wanted to, he could just put it away, and I had no hope of reaching it.
No, none.
And I said, Don, he's number one in the world. He said, I don't give a shit.
It doesn't matter.
The whole world for me is tennis, and I am so far behind.
Yeah.
You know, I think that'd probably be the same thing for our...
Well, and it's interesting because I'm being facetious and stuff. It was fun to feel that, you know, kind of I had... It was a little progress, and all it meant was that I was able to mimic a stroke, right? I watched Federer, and I'm not a good athlete, at least I'm a good mimic. I can kind of mimic. I'm coordinated enough to look like I'm a good athlete.
But that's how you become a good athlete.
Maybe.
Is by mimicry.
Well, yes, but I don't have the temperament to win, and I certainly don't have the, you know... Now you're talking about... So I guess my forehand and my backhand is... Because I've been taught the right way, I can mimic something good. Now, okay, I get immense satisfaction over the fact that I have at least learned how to groove that stroke, and sometimes I hit it well and it feels great. I can get a great rally. There are levels to accomplishment, right? And so the next level would be, well, how's your serve? How's your slice? There are about 12 different strokes. And then how do you put a game together? And I'm 50. It ain't going to happen, right? I mean, maybe I could, if I replied myself, I could play in some level 5 tournaments. And I don't know.
It didn't happen if you were 30 either.
That's probably right. But there's something really wonderful about accomplishment in all its increments and just doing the damn thing.
Of course.
Right?
I mean, the happiness is the use of all the ones.
Talents along the lines of excellence.
All
that's right.
Powers along the lines of excellence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Big Mike has officially just stopped talking to the microphone.
Yeah. Well, I think
the
we're
microphone
done.
Will come.
I think
to
we're
him.
Done here because I want the point of this is I just wanted to kind of talk about how good I am at tennis now.
Well, but I think Brian, I mean, to turn that into sort of a teaching principle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, firstly, that is how the path to mastery begins, is through mimicry. You fake it, and then slowly but surely you
that's
make it.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of how humans acquire culture.
Yeah.
And, you know,
talk about that, Hunter. That's interesting because I think what you're getting at is that young people will copy the older people.
That's right.
Because it's prestige and they just want to wear the clothing and they want to talk like that person, which is how culture's passed down, right?
Yep.
And then they make it their own.
And they work their way into understanding how does the person think, what is their approach, what are they looking for. And then
they add to that if they're smart enough.
And the key thing is crucially, you know, I think Jared Diamond summed it up best when he told us that story about that 4A tribesman who was, you know, using that computer. And he said, the brain is there what's missing is the opportunity. Mm. And, you know, you think about someone we had on like Freeway Rick Ross, who, you know,
he was the father of the crack cocaine epidemic.
That's right. And the point is that it's because he never learned how to read or write. He had to wait until he went to prison. But there, humans are resourceful.
Yeah.
And the problem is that most people never find out what they're capable of.
Yeah, that's the biggest crime.
Yeah. And that's the crime that I feel it is my responsibility to fix.
Well, I think you are. I mean, I think, you know.
Well, but we need celebrities to be the face of that, Brian. And that's where you are so important.
Well, if my show had gone, I might have been a celebrity. I don't
you
know.
You are a celebrity, Brian. Yeah.
Well, it's
you
been.
You are a celebrity.
Yeah. Well.
And increasingly in this community, I mean, what your father doesn't realize is that, you know, you are the face of this movement. You are the emperor.
Just because I've gotten to know you, Hunter.
No, but listen, Brian, you know, the people have elected you, they've selected you, and they want you to lead them to the promised land.
I like it. I like it. Hopefully there are a lot of loose girls who have low self-esteem and loose morals and are attracted to married guys with two kids. What? What am I saying?
Well, Brian, the joke on the Facebook
I want to be a cult leader.
Yeah, but
you're all pregnant with my children. Now let me finish.
You already are a cult leader, but the joke has been always, how quickly does the cult turn into a sex cult?
Well,
and the answer is about 5 seconds.
I was going to say, as soon as Brian gets a free hand... As soon as my wife tells me I'm allowed, I just don't want to lose my house. I like my neighborhood.
Well, you just have to become powerful enough that you can't be held accountable. And once you can no longer be held accountable, then you can go into a sex cult.
That's that Joe Rogan said, you know, my girlfriend was telling me, or my wife at the time, my wife was like, you know, or when they were dating, said, my wife was like, I want to be best friends. And he said, well, you're not my best friend. She goes, why not? We need to be friends. Because he said, if we were best friends, you'd let me have sex with other women. You willing to do that? Because that's what my best friend would let me do. It was great. So there it is. Yeah.
So a sex
Hunter, cult. I want to thank you for being the relentless driving force. I know I get spread thin and I know I get busy, but I appreciate these conversations. I learn a lot. I've learned a lot from you.
Well, I've learned a lot from Big Mike.
Yeah, and we all have.
And the point is that, you know, why have I been exposed to the work of people like Thomas Sowell? It's because of that. And you and I were lucky enough to grow up in and around a culture that valued learning about other cultures. I mean, that
I was a terrible student, but I know what you mean.
No, but I mean, there was a curiosity there. Yes. But also, why were you a terrible student,
Brian? I had active glands.
No, it wasn't glands, okay. I don't think. No. This goes back to, I mean, that...
I was never taught how to really focus or study, or I just... It was a very, you know, it was a new thing. I mean, I just... Yeah. So much of this stuff is... having the right tutor, the right teacher, the right context, someone to break it down into a language that you understand. And yep. Everybody understands different languages, you know, or at least you have to speak to people in different ways. And I think and a classic example is this guy, David Maxwell, who teaches my children. The way he teaches them how to play tennis, you can't help but win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're grooving your stroke. There is a way to do something. There is a criteria and a step-by-step process to being educated.
Yep.
To being physically stronger, to being healthier, to being having more energy. There are ways to do that. It's Pareto's principle too. It's, you know, where should your effort go?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need to apply a lot of effort. You just have to be pinpointed about it.
That's right.
And a good coach, a good tutor, a good teacher knows how to do that.
That's
so,
right.
So, you know, that's, and anyway, the art of learning is not taught enough.
Well, and that's part of what we're going to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And a really good emperor shares these sort of munificence with his
love
people.
That word. I love munificence.
Yeah.
I am in the mood for munificence. But I wish it'd be very hard for me to be an emperor when I don't speak this way. I want to be lazy. I want to be lazy and I would kill some people. I would just say, I don't know what to do with all these people. They're ignorant. Kill them, please. But don't do it around me. I don't want to hear the screams. I'm taking my bath. And then I would have, if there was a major resistance, I would, this is how I would bring their leader to me. Bring their leader to me. And Jonathan, break him first.
I think that's the perfect way to end this podcast. Just so that you guys all know that you're signing up for a sex cult where you will learn how to learn.
It's time for your purification ritual. I'm going to place my middle-aged white hands on your body. Trust me. I am leaning over you. Sorry about the big vein in my head. Oh, God. I know I smell like coffee and perversion. But believe me, this is very good. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is a family show.
Degenerated.
This is degenerated. I hope you've learned everything once again. This has been another episode.
Your mother is sitting here and weeping.
She's got her hands over her eyes. Big Mike, thanks for joining the mother of all podcasts.
Always a pleasure.
Mixed Mental Arts. All right, ladies and gentlemen, go to themixedmentalarts.co for reading lists, for articles, and too bad there are no pictures of me, but I'll take my shirt off and snap some off for you.
Yeah, and I think there are also enough of those on the internet that we could actually just Google image search. There's one of you in the shower.
Thank you, Anthony Weiner.
there's an amazing one of you in the shower, which is really...
That Will Sasso, that son of a bitch, took that picture.
It's a really good one.
Yeah. All right, kids.
And the one thing that I would like to just sort of end on is the fact that part of what we're going to be doing with Mixed Mental Arts is raising humanity's IQ faster than it has ever been raised before. That's what culture is.
Because what makes you smarter is downloading culture, not your cognitive ability.
Yeah.
According to Joseph Henrich. And
a whole lot of research.
All right, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks, guys.